probably to explore these topics, because the narrative is very much dominated by the kind of, if you can say, Anglo-Saxon world, and the big topics that are important there are obviously important in those contexts, but do they actually translate into different places? Oh, Sergey, we have some feedback there. We might need like earphones or something for you. So if you want to go grab those, that would be useful. I don't know why. Yeah, sometimes feel. Here we go. Anyway, we're live, everybody. So welcome to Brain Food Live on air. We're bringing it to you. I would say every Friday. We're bringing it forward this week because it's Thursday morning here in the UK and in Europe. So surprise everyone who is watching this show. I just wanted to let you know why we shifted this time. It's because we're doing a special show where we're speaking to recruitment leaders in Middle East and North Africa. And we wanted to obviously respect the fact that everyone is on the weekend starts on Friday in that region. So hence we are doing this on Thursday, and hopefully we can learn a huge amount about, I would say, an underreported region as far as the world of recruiting is concerned. So just a quick sound check. Sergey, are you back with us? How does it all sound? I've got rid of that horrible feedback.
I can hear you well.
Perfect. Okay, just a quick sound check for everybody, by the way. For people who are watching this, we should be live on three places. If you can hear me on LinkedIn, on Crowdcast, by the way, can you give us a thumbs up or just say yes on the chat bar there and let me know you can hear me okay? If we are live on LinkedIn, which we should be, can you give us a thumbs up or give me one of those emoticon things? Let me know whether you can hear me okay. It would be good to know. I'm broadcasting from a hotel, by the way, in Hong Kong. So I'm very concerned about the Wi-Fi here. So just make sure everyone can hear me there. And finally, we are pushing this out on the Facebook group as well. And we should be live there. So if you can hear me in the Brain Food online community on Facebook, let me know. Okay, we're getting a few yeses there. That's perfect. I think at least Crowdcast can hear us. I believe that LinkedIn can hear us as well. And I think Facebook can hear us too. So all good. All right, let's get on with the show. Firstly, I need to reintroduce a very good friend of mine who I'm delighted to bring on back to the show. He's co-piloting with me today. Not only is he the sponsor of the show today, by the way, but he's also going to do some work for us because he's the co-host of Brain Food Live. This is Sergey Makhmedov, the CEO of APAC and the rest of the world for Daxtra. Sergey, how are you doing, sir?
Hi, Hung. I'm fine. Thank you. How is everyone doing? I hope everyone is well. And nice to join your show again. Thank you for inviting
me. And, you know, as part of the compensation for you doing this effort, Sergey, you've got like maybe 30 seconds to describe what Daxtra is and why people should pay attention to Daxtra. Go.
Right. Well, in Hung's own words, Daxtra is on the mission. Can you hear me, guys?
I can hear you. I think everyone can.
Okay. It's just the sound is playing up with me. If you can hear me, that's great. But let me just try and disconnect my headphones.
Oh, we've got mega feedback here.
That doesn't work. Okay, that should be sorted now. Is it sorted now?
I can hear you clear, crystal clear. It might be that you're not hearing me very well, Sergey. It might be one of these where you got to take one ear out, one ear in.
Let's try that. I don't know. Never happened to me before, so sorry. Why don't you guys carry on and I'll try and sort it out. I'll try and find some wired headphones.
No worries. Do you want to go do that, Sergey? We've got plenty of time. So so go and grab yourself some if you've got them. And we'll come back. Yeah, no worries. Okay, everybody. So just whilst we check out and sort out these sound problems, I just wanted to, you know, get a little bit of an idea of what you think are the priority problems for recruiting in the Middle East and North Africa. Obviously, I want to caveat that by saying it's a huge region. I really dislike it when you kind of like lump regions together. There is obviously cultural contiguity in many respects, but we recognize as many differences within this region itself. But perhaps we can talk about it as a general category. I wanted to just get a feel for you guys from an outsider that knows nothing about recruiting here. What are the priority concerns for businesses recruiting in this area? Does anybody have any ideas? I'd love to hear what your opinions are on the chat stream there. So if you do have any, please let us know. We've got a poll going, by the way. So if you're on Crowdcast, again, I've tried to ask that question, and there's a load of things there in which you can put your vote in. So I'll ask you to kind of apply your votes to this. I've put five things. Number one, staff retention. Is that the top priority for you guys this year? Hiring qualified staff, is that top priority? How about diversifying the workforce? Is this a conversation that's being had in the Middle East and North Africa, and is that important? What about the shift of candidate and employee expectations, i.e. is remote working a thing here? We know, for instance, in APAC, it wasn't so much. So, you know, these are revelations that people from the outside often don't know. And finally, we all know about this localization laws. Like, how significant is that? Is that a persistent challenge? And is it still one of the top priorities of the business? So I can see some votes going in there. That's perfect. Keep piling them in there. That's going to be super useful for us. Okay, Sergey, you're back. Can you hear us?
Yes, so far I have been able to hear you. And the minute I start talking, I disconnect.
You disconnect I'm not sure what we can do there. It might be, I take it there's no wired headphones that we could potentially use. No? Don't worry about it, Sergey. We can continue as best we can. We've lost them completely.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you fine. I think we've always been able to do that.
All right. Sorry about this. It's just I keep losing the sound.
Okay.
I think I'm online. Apologies. If I disappear, just carry on without me. And
for the preservation of the show, you have to continue. The show must go on, Sergey.
Exactly. Listen,
Sergey, we're getting some comments here. You and I are both, I would not describe us as ignorant, but we're definitely not experts at this because we're operating in different parts of the world. And our experience of the Middle East and North Africa region is light, to say the least, compared to our experience elsewhere. In your interactions with businesses in the Middle East, how has that been different compared to, let's say, Asia Pac or Europe or the US and places like that? What are the recruiting challenges? Are they different?
I am not an expert in the Middle East. I've never lived in the Middle East, but we do have customers in the Middle East, and the challenges are very similar between customers in the Middle East and elsewhere, because what we do, we automate business processes in recruitment. And we're dealing with resumes that we match to jobs and vice versa. So this probably applies across the globe.
Are there resume differences? Well, one of the things that Daxtra do quite well is to understand how to process like cultural and even language differences in how a resume is constructed. So like, do Middle East and North Africa generally follow, let's say, a French format, or is it more like a US format, or how does it work with the resumes here?
There are some differences, but by and large, I would say they're the same. The major difference and challenge for us is the language. When we have to deal with Middle Eastern languages, be it Arabic or Hebrew, so we're just beginning to do some advanced work on Arabic language, but we're pretty advanced on Hebrew.
Yeah. Again, very interesting. Different scripts, right? So a lot of us in the industry, a lot of people who watch Brain Food, love sourcing, love Boolean sourcing, and all that type of stuff. How exactly are you meant to do that with Arabic? Is it even possible? Can you do a Boolean search on Hebrew? Is that possible? Theoretically,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, it's our search is pretty language independent, but when it comes to parsing resumes or matching, where we need to infer certain words because explicit words in job description are not necessarily the same used by candidates, then we need to use a lot of linguistics. That's where the challenges come in.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Anyway, let's bring on some experts that do know what they're talking about. So we're going to bring on John Dudley here, who is the Middle East and North Africa recruitment lead for EY. And I know he's got a lot of his team watching here today, so it's going to be super interesting. Thank you for your comments, by the way, Krista, Alex, Andros, and Roy, and Bass as well. Please do comment. By the way, we might be bringing you on the screen if you offer it, so make sure you got your makeup on and all that kind of stuff. Brain Food is one of these shows where crowd casted can typically be invited in. But let's bring on John first and Melissa, and they can help us think through these issues. I think this should be John Dudley. There's only one John here. And let's bring on Melissa Sumner as well at the same time. And hopefully this will work. I think we're going to be on four different continents here. Actually, no, you and I are in the same place, Sergey. John is in, I believe, Dubai. And Melissa might have moved recently to Europe. So let's see if we can get them on screen okay. I'd love to do some time out here. I think, you know, there was once a prospect of me, like, moving to the... is that John?
This is John.
John, how are you doing? How wonderful to see you.
I'm sorry, say again?
Can you hear me, John?
I can hear you now, yes. Thank you. Okay. I have to, full disclaimer, I had to go out and reboot and come back in using Chrome instead of Edge because I was having some issues. I logged in just as you said, and John Dudley might have something to say about this. So you're going to have to prep me with what this is. I just want to say thank you. I want to say thank you because I emailed you maybe a year ago and said, look, I really want to attend, and so does my team, but you know, Fridays are our weekend. So thank you for doing this first and hopefully not last special Thursday edition of Recruiting Brain Food.
You know what? No problem, John. And I always had that in mind because I tried to do a previous show to this and I had it on Friday, and I was told by local people at the time it was not a suitable time, and I abandoned it because of that advice. So when you reminded me, say, hey, you wanted to move this, it was like, okay, that's the second time someone's got to tell me that there's not going to be a third time I'm moving it. I'm pleased to be here and great to be learning from everyone in the crowd and learning from people on screen as well. I think Melissa's trying to get on, but whilst we wait for her, let's quickly introduce yourself, John. Who are you and what it is you do?
Thank you. My name is John Dudley. I am, as you said, EY's recruitment leader for our Middle East North Africa region, which is 16 countries. So I lead experienced hire recruitment, campus recruitment, and our 2-year-old contingent worker recruitment in the region. We hire about 2,500 people a year. As most people who are in this region attending the call know, it's a very complex region with issues that aren't around elsewhere. My overall time with EY is about 17 years. Before coming here into this role 3 years ago, I led recruitment efforts in the U.S. for EY as well as in Latin America.
And, amazing.
Pleasure to be here.
That's fantastic, John. You look like you might be the global expert about this topic. We should just all be quiet and have you lecture us on this. Before we do that, let's welcome Melissa Sumner onto the show. Melissa, great to see you. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Nice to be here.
So Melissa, for people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself, like who you are and what it is you do?
Yeah, happy to. My background is in psychology. So I studied psychology and then became a chartered occupational psychologist. The early part, sort of 2/3 of my career, was in talent consulting, so executive level all the way down to entry level talent consulting. And then about 7 years ago, I moved to the Middle East. I moved to Dubai and joined Emirates. starting off in a very broad talent role. Then I headed up their talent assessment team for the, globally. And then for my sins, I was asked to move into talent acquisition, where I led seven teams there, including talent engagement, candidate experience, talent assessment, and then also some recruiting teams. And now I work at William Grant and Sons, so I'm now moving back westwards, and I head up global talent for them. So looking after the talent management and the talent acquisition side of things.
That's right. And you've recently moved to Scotland or something, haven't you, Melissa? So this is like, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, is that Scottish sunshine we see
it's
in the
not.
Background?
No, it's not. I'm in Greece at the moment. I've got.
I was about to say it doesn't look anything like Scotland. I can see
green, and
I can see like
it's
sun.
Pretty cool.
That's not Scotland. Whilst we're bouncing around a little bit on the internet there, John, let's go to you on this. With regards to the major concerns, like you mentioned, there's actually some unique differences for recruiters working in the Middle East compared to other places. What would those things be? If you had like 60 seconds to give someone a debrief, like if I called you up, John, and said, hey, listen, I got a job in Dubai, I'm going to go tomorrow. And you could give me like 60 seconds, say, Hung, you got to know this, this, and this. Otherwise, you're gonna spend a lot of time, waste your time. What are those things? What are you going to say to me?
What I'm first going to say, because I have so many members of my team here, is I've never done anything in 60 seconds, but I'll try. and especially with the complexity of this region. Well, first of all, you know, we hire in this region, we hire a lot of expats, right? So there is so much more to visa and immigration than you deal with in the US, UK, Europe, etc. Because in most markets, you already have to have either be a citizen or have a valid work authorization and an existing visa that you can transfer. Here, we take on new visa applications. 16 countries all have different immigration rules. So it's just a lot of complexity, a lot of time.
Okay, before you go on, let's just chew on this one. Firstly, why is that? And what is the, what is the component of the expat community on the average yearly intake, let's say, and why is that the case?
For us, it's primarily in the experienced hire realm, not the campus hire realm. And it's more than 50%, probably less than 70% of our hires. And it's simply a reality, and this is changing, but historically, we are a consulting firm. Our clients hire us for our expertise. And there just hasn't historically been the talent market here for the expertise that our clients are paying for. So we have to bring them in. Now, this actually leads to my second point, and then I promise that'll be the two that to answer your question. The second point is this: diversity and inclusion is different here than elsewhere. And it really took me a little bit to get my head around it, because, you know, elsewhere you try to hire people who maybe look, you know, different than the greater population or the native population. Here, because primarily the Gulf countries, the oil-rich countries, have provided for their citizens, their nationals, you know, quite well because of the oil money. But they realize peak oil is coming, and they need to do something to enable their people to be self-sufficient. And so the big countries, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, etc., have put in various requirements for firms like us to hire nationals. That means the D&I here isn't hiring someone who looks different. It's hiring a native, a national,
yeah.
You know, and it's challenging, right? And these are not just nice goals. In some cases, they can lead to financial penalties. They could actually close down a company. So we take it very, very seriously. And I'm proud of the fact that we are ahead of the curve in these areas. But it's not easy, and it requires attention. Why? Because of what I just said. You know, if you're looking for someone with 7 to 10 years of consulting experience in cybersecurity who is a national, probably doesn't
exist. Happen.
Yep. Right? We need to develop them ourselves. That's why what I said about campus. Most of those people are national hires, because that's how we could grow it.
You know what? This reminds me a little bit of the conversation that you hear in the UK, US, and places like that when we're looking at ethnic minorities into tech, for instance. And we know that over-indexing on tenure is actually one of the big problems which prevents that solution. Because if you're looking for a, if you're saying, hey, I need 15 years software engineering experience, guess what? That's going to be a white dude, German, or maybe an Asian dude, maybe. It isn't going to be a black female, for instance, or your chances of that person being a black female are very, very low. So you can't really apply that rule. You have to really amend that tenure and or stop indexing on it. And very similar, simply because there hasn't been a history of that population group doing that, that type of work. So you've introduced, I would say, two big, big challenges that would be very different to someone who's on the outside in. Let's look at each of those two things in turn, John. Firstly, with the visa issue, visa processing. So if you're hiring 2,000 people and you're saying 50%, that's 1,000 people need visa processing and they're coming from all kinds of different places in the world, like how much time, have you calculated how much time you're like per person is required to do the visa processing?
Well, look, here's the reason I'm laughing is you just have so many permutations, right? We've got 16 countries with their own laws, right? We won't even get to the fact that some cities or entities, government entities have different laws than others in the same country. You've got different laws and provisions depending on where that candidate, what nationality that candidate is, and what country they're coming from, which could be different than their nationality. So there is no average. I mean, the average would be meaningless. What we do know is this: it takes time, and every case is unique, and every case requires some handholding. And so, and then you have to do the other thing, right? You don't necessarily. We advise people don't resign until you get your visa. Well, if it takes 3 months to get a visa and they have a 60-day notice period, you know it's going to be 6 months before they come in the door. So this is a reality we deal with. This is something I never had to deal with anywhere else. And professional services, if you don't have the people on your payroll, they're not generating revenue, right? So our stakeholders are pushing us to get them on board as fast as we can, but we are, you know, really held back or held by the government and entities and the requirements for each.
You know what? This is very interesting because when you're in a place that traditionally doesn't hire a lot of people that doesn't require visas, let's say Europe is a classic example because of the big talent pool in the EU freedom of movement, you hire anybody in there, it's all good. It's often the case that if the person does require a visa, the candidate doesn't require a visa, you veto the candidate straight away because of the admin load is not worth it. You say, no, sorry, there's another candidate here I might as well spend time on because you're going to take me 3 months. So basically, hiring cycles are longer, I would say.
Hiring cycles are longer, and there's an oxymoron or a paradox here, right? Which is, it's great. We can hire people almost literally from all over the world. That's great. Then we get thousands of applicants, right? So now you have to have the people power or AI, which we're looking at to screen and get through that. You're absolutely right. In most other countries, now you just reject them, right? The system can reject them. You don't have valid work authorization. Here, it's thousands of, sometimes thousands for one job that we have to go through.
Yeah, so that's another challenge is candidate management then, because the jobs that you're posting, you accept that it's going to be outside in, but you can't necessarily determine from where, you know, and actually maybe you don't mind so much. It's like you just need the quality candidate, but you then have to prepare yourself for the fact that you're going to get flooded with however many numbers. So massive candidate volume. How do you deal with that? Do you have technology to deal with it? Or is it still a case where you've got human beings having to grind through a massive inbox?
Yeah, the answer is yes. Every way we can. So we have new technology, a new ATS that will be going live in about 6 weeks' time. And we're very much looking forward to that. We have a legacy ATS we've been using for about 15 years. I will leave the vendor name out of it, but it was great 15 years ago. It has its limitations today. So right now we use pre-qualifying questions to at least narrow down what we have to look at. But quite frankly, to answer your question right now, we have to augment. We hire some people as interns who we can train them on here's what we're looking for, and they have to go through each record. They just have to. And you all know this, right? Everybody on this call knows this. You have to go through because you're going to find those jewels who did apply, who are really great. But they are jewels, and they are difficult to find. Now, we are very much looking at AI. I sort of have a reputation, I think, within EY globally as being an early adopter of technology platforms. And I've started to look at some things, but EY globally is adopting something. I'm not at liberty to say who and what. The win will be within the next 12 months and probably less than that after we get our new ATS on board. Without it, you know, AI is really one asset that can make a difference when you have so many applications to go through.
I have to ask the question because we've got Daxter here as part of the call. Like, would this AI involve some sort of textual parsing, or would it involve interacting with the candidate for the applicant to kind of respond in like way? Because there's two kind of ways to deal with it, isn't there? Where let's do a parse of the text that they've sent us, or interact with the person with a chatbot and try and pull out the information from there, or maybe a combination of both. Can you give us some indication there?
Yeah. So look, you are right. There are two different parallel paths, or not parallel, but both paths are valid, and one doesn't replace the other. And I, quite frankly, I'm not involved in these negotiations and decisions at a global level. That's my disclaimer. But I can tell you that I think as a best practice, obviously there needs to be something where you can train the AI to look, not only look at skills, but as recruiters go through and reject or accept, it learns from that, right? That's pretty basic IA stuff, but it's really critical to this. There's also intelligent chatbots, right? Which I think is kind of more what you're heading with your second part of that question, where there's interaction, and based on that interaction, it can help to screen in or screen out. I don't know if that's part of the suite that's coming in the next 12 months. Or not?
Yeah, the reason why I asked this question, it may not be suitable because of the multi-language issue that you're inevitably going to have with people coming into different places. But in high volume retail, we're seeing chatbots being used quite a lot because it's a very quick way for the candidate to knock themselves out if they're not suitable. Like if you're not going to hire this person because literally you can't offer that the person a contract for these reasons, the candidate themselves doesn't want to be in that process. So it's a quick way to make sure that the people who cannot be offered the job do not kind of go further and waste any more of their time in this process, and it can be redirected elsewhere. So exciting stuff. So candidate volume, a huge issue. Let's talk about the language side of it. You're getting input from all kinds of languages coming in. Is there the expats that you do hire, do they universally have a single language? Is it English that everyone needs to have? Or what is the language component for, say, Arabic and stuff like this?
Well, let's first of all, I think as a baseline, the business language in the region is English. Okay, that is the business language, not just at EY, but in general, it's the language in the region. I mean, if you think back 50 years ago, this was most of these countries were under the British realm.
Right.
So we actually don't have that much of an issue with having to have multiple languages. English is a requirement, and that's just black and white. Arabic is highly desired because our clients that's their language, and you can communicate nuances when you're in consulting. There's a lot of nuances, so the ability to speak Arabic is a plus. Sometimes it is a requirement, but most of the time it's not a hard requirement, but a nice to have.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting.
Yeah, it is. And you would say probably that combination of Arabic and English might be a once upon a time reasonably rare, but with second generation populations in Europe, I would imagine a lot of them growing up bilingual, I would imagine a lot of them would be quite valuable resources potentially for this region if they're able to, you know, communicate with both of those registers. So super, super interesting. What about the, and I'm just battering you with questions here, John, but I'm fascinated by the kind of the setting you've laid out for us. If in a scenario that I'm familiar with, when you've got loads of candidates, typically you end up not doing any active sourcing, because you already know there's so much effort required to process the inbound candidates that you've got. And you probably know in there's going to be, as you say, the gold. You're going to get your guy or get your girl in that group of inbound. Does that mean that a recruiter in this region, generally speaking, is going to be, the skills are more going to be towards the processing of volume as opposed to the hunting for specific candidates?
There's a part one and a part two to that. So the part one is, I think sourcing strategies are key and critical, because yes, we get a lot of applicants and yes, you find jewels, but you don't always find that rich talent you're looking for. The rich talent, and I just read a report by Gartner, I think it was Gartner last week, that said that passive candidates who are sourced and hired outperform people who actually apply to a company's website. So there is absolute validity to that. And the part two of this is I have actually implemented in the starting a year and a half ago a sourcing function within my team where we, you know, it's in a way it's mimicking the agency model, where you've got the people who are out hunting and finding, attracting and engaging candidates, and once they're interested, then handing them over to the recruiter to work through the interviews, etc. So we have a very robust team of about a dozen sourcing recruiters supporting the recruitment team here. This is now becoming a global model for us, and it's really, really efficient and effective. They are business partners. They are recruiters. They are sourcing recruiters. They are not just, you know, going out and CV mining, resume mining. And it's allowed us to reduce our agency spend, increase our time to hire. I mean, shorten our time to hire, increase the quality of hire. So sourcing is absolutely key. It doesn't go away. Volume, it doesn't necessarily equal quality.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, maybe those two roles actually will bifurcate as it seems to have done, because you can't imagine someone who's having to handle like hundreds and thousands of candidates, then having the time or even the mind space to be able to deal with, you know, what can be a very long search. Searching can sometimes be solved in half an hour, or it could take you several weeks or months. So, you know, you can't really account or predict the time required there.
I will tell you that this is not an original idea. I have absolutely no problem of taking something someone else has done and if it works, stealing it, so to speak. On a legal basis. So this was something that 10 years ago, the US firm piloted, because you have recruiters who are just really good sourcing and they enjoy that. They don't so much enjoy the stakeholder interaction and all of that. And of course, then you have the recruiters who enjoy the negotiation of candidates and dealing with stakeholders, et cetera. So they, a separate parallel career path was formed by hiring us. Now, as a recruiter at the time, I didn't like it. I didn't like giving up my LinkedIn license. I didn't like giving up control over finding my candidates for my recs, for my hiring manager. And I know that must resonate. I know it resonated with some of the people on my team when we did this. But the fact is, I teamed with my first sourcing recruiter. We teamed well. I taught him. I mean, I didn't teach him recruiting, but I taught him the business that we supported, which was in the M&A area. And it was we became an engine, right? We became an engine of hiring consulting talent, and it works. So not my own idea, but it's effective and efficient, and I, you know, it's something that other recruitment leaders should look at.
Yeah, I think so. I've had this conversation with a couple of businesses that are keen to scale out, you know, hire at high growth, because the, you know, the business is on that type of plan or trajectory, and inevitably differentiating the roles in the TA team is a big part of how they do that, because it's simply more efficient. It is less ownership. It is less, if you like, artisanal service, you know, concierge service for the hiring manager, maybe. But it's more efficient because you develop better skills, better networks, and you also broaden your pool of talent for your TA team, because you may have some people that really struggle with some parts of the job, but if you make the job in some respects simpler, or there's less components to the job, you can get, like, expand your time to hire the people you need to hire, if that makes any sense. So yeah, I think this seems to be a very popular model, and interesting to see it employed for you guys over at EY.
There's also some other benefits for the team members themselves. So for the recruiters who have the, what I call consultative recruiters, who have the relationship with the business, they have an opportunity to grow their career skills by mentoring and partnering with someone on the sourcing side to help them understand the business, et cetera. And likewise for these sourcing recruiters, you know, they don't work in a vacuum. They are on the intake calls with hiring managers, and they are on pipeline discussions. So they get the visibility and exposure to leadership that they might not. So there's just a lot of reasons for doing that beyond just the obvious speed to hire and savings of money.
Let's talk about the tooling that is involved in things like sourcing and advertising, even, John. Is that very different from, you know, what the universal sort of usage would be? Is it everyone's still using LinkedIn, for instance, and, you know, it's generally post a job here and it'll work? Or is there any kind of Middle East, North Africa specific things that, you know, are kind of local tools that are particularly useful?
I mean, we do use all of the tools that most people use, both from you know, a sourcing perspective and from a social media perspective. I think there are some differences. I think the key one for us is that we, of course, everyone globally is looking for female talent. For us, it's a super high priority because we have some extra challenges around that. One is that traditionally, in this region, women didn't always work, and so we have a challenge around that. Secondly, it is just a fact that it's often harder to get a woman who has a family to move. That's changing, but it still exists. So we spend a lot of our employer branding efforts focused on attracting women. We really believe that if a woman wants a career in professional services, what we provide here at EY, and especially in MENA, there is no better place for them to work. And we want to get that message out there. The other area that's really important, going back to what I said at the beginning, is the recruitment of nationals. And we have been successful at that. But if we don't tell the world, especially this world, our local world here, about the successes in Asia, and we don't show them people like them in jobs that are not only challenging, but I quite frankly, incredible. The work that we do for our clients is really cool and amazing in many cases. So we do a lot to showcase, whether they're Emirati nationals or Saudi nationals or Omani nationals, in roles, because we celebrate what they're doing. But we also want people to say, wow, that looks like me. I'm interested in this.
That's so important as well, you know, to have visible representation. That's actually a redundancy, but to have representation, to give inspiration for other people going forward is super important. We actually know this is true even Even in places like US and UK, for instance, where people have a lack of understanding, I can do that because I've seen someone who looks like me do this. At a young kid will start imprinting in their minds whether that is a potential career path. And they'll start making choices at a very, very young age, educationally even, based on what they see. So very, very important that those messages are projected. I want to ask one more question on the gender side before we dive into the naturalization aspect of it. Staying with the expat side on recruiting on gender, the MENA does have a reputation to say, look, there is very traditional values in this area, particularly when it comes to segregation of genders, gender roles, and so forth. What kind of stuff do you need to be aware of if you're moving across into this area as a candidate? Let's say applying a universal standard in any way, but at least being sensitive to, what this person, the real talk this person needs to understand when they come over here.
Well, I think the first thing that the world needs to understand is, yes, there is, like anywhere, a history here, a rich history. But times change, and it is no longer true that women are second-class citizens, so to speak. In the countries here, every country has made strides for equal rights and representation of women. From a business perspective, of course, that's great, but just from a human perspective, it's really wonderful. So, I mean, even just in the 3 years I've been here, the changes that have happened in Saudi, first time I went there, every woman was covered in abaya, et cetera. Last time I went there pre-pandemic, you could see people's faces. It has changed and it is changing. So I think what I would let anyone know, is that this region is not its stereotypical past. It has a lot of change that's occurred. It's continuing to change. There are progressive movements. And for women especially, there's fantastic opportunities. We've done something here for the past few years at EY, which we call a returnship for women who have left the workforce here, either to have a family or for other reasons, to let them know that if they want to come back to work, they can come back, try it out, see how it feels, right? No, try before you buy, both sides. And it's been really successful. I have several members of my team who are on this call who came in under a returnship. So I sort of digressed. But
no, that's also a really interesting idea. So because this is applicable everywhere, right?
Say it's applicable globally, yeah.
Well, and it's actually really important because what we've seen during the pandemic is actually a potential crisis of women leaving the labor force because of childcare issues, because of inadequate sort of alternatives. All this type of stuff. And you're saying what you've instituted is basically this person can have their job back, is what you're saying, or have a similar level job if they wanted.
Or have a job that they never thought that they would do, but they have skills that allow them to work in a professional services environment. So come in and try it out. Try it out for 6 months. See how it is. Mm. And we, I would say our conversion rate was around 80%. 75-80%, which is good.
You know what? Isn't that a great idea, folks? It takes away the stress of having to apply for stuff, doesn't it? I mean, if you're like ambivalent, let's say you've made a life decision, you've decided, I want to go back to here, have my child there, or whatever it is. There's all kinds of reasons why you might want to do these things. But then instead of having to reapply and go through that psychological kind of barrier to put yourself through it, to fully commit in this way. What John is saying is actually you can have, you can try before you buy. You don't need to do a full commit right up front. We know you've made a big life decision. We're not going to say change your life straight away. Dip your toe in, give it a shot. And if it doesn't work out, no worries. You can go back to where you were, as you were, with no kind of impact whatsoever, or you can actually, you know, have this option. I think a wonderful idea. Probably takes a progressive company combined with big budget, though, John.
Not necessarily. I'm not remembering the name of the vendor when we first started this. They came to us and they put together this returnship career fair with companies from all over here in Dubai. I will get the name out and get credit where it's due. But it was a no-brainer, no pun intended with the name of this. It was a no-brainer because the costs were reasonable and the return was great. And it doesn't cost much, right? They are doing work, so we are benefiting.
You're getting value, yeah, of course. And you know what? It's great that an outside vendor had the idea. Please do find out who they are, and let's give them some credit, because I think that's great innovation. Sometimes it does take outside support, to think a little bit around the box on some of these things. So that's superb.
Actually, the name of the vendor, it should be just obvious on the tip of my tongue because of the topic. It's called Women at Work.
Women at Work. Perfect. If anybody's got a link to that, please share it in the chat stream. Let's give them some attention. It'll be good to figure a little bit more about them out. Okay, let's shift it to the other big sort of component of the challenge, John. Naturalization. There's some hard quarters there. Give us some numbers, John. What are the numbers you need to hit on your intake and employee base and workforce composition, stuff like this?
Here's the thing. The numbers don't, they tell a story, but they don't tell the impact. Okay. So I can tell you in the UAE, the government here has set a goal of 4% Emiratis. And that sounds like 4%. Boy, that's a pretty meager goal. That shouldn't be hard. But you have to remember something. Okay. The population of Dubai is 5 million people. 95% of those people are expats. The other 5% aren't consultants necessarily. So, 4% is not an easy number to hit. Interestingly enough, our MENA region chairman, Abdulaziz in Riyadh, has set us a goal of 10%, much more aggressive than what the government has done. And we're tracking it, but it's not easy. So the numbers aren't important. It's the
what is the challenge, John? All right, you have to do this. So is there a penalty? Let's go to there first. Government set this. It's a 4%. You have to do it. Is there a penalty? And if so, can you tell us what that is?
It depends on the country, okay? And the penalties are not. Look, this isn't meant to be a heavy-handed approach. This is an honorable goal. I really support. I really support this. I mean, eventually, the person in this role shouldn't look like me. It should look like someone, who goes to a mosque here. But the point is that we have potentially financial penalties if we're not at all tracking, right? But the goal is to have a partnership, not to have a whip. And we have been really fortunate to have some innovative ideas and to partner with the various governments, both here and in Saudi, to do what we can to hire nationals. And I think it's important to recognize that. The challenge we have is just the lack of people with the experience that we need, which we are addressing by bringing junior people in, but there's that. We also we got to call it out for what it is. It's very difficult to compete with the government. The government pays better than the private sector, and they work less hours. And that's just a fact. That's not a negative. It's not a positive. It's just a reality. So you have to find somebody who is qualified, who is really interested in a career, not money, but in a career. And those people exist, but it takes time and effort. And good recruiters and good branding to do that.
You mentioned that the government is the competitor for the existing talent there. Are these people then civil servants? Are they basically employed to do work within the government, or are they kind of given a stipend as almost like a basic income?
No. They are civil servants. They are working. They are working hard. They are providing value to the government. It's just that for, you know, an internal auditor at a government entity generally is paid better than what one of us in the accounting profession pay. Again, that's not a knock or a negative. It's just a reality. And I don't know that we so much compete for talent as we just have a dynamic to deal with and to work with.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. And I wouldn't sort of dismiss the financial side of it. I think, didn't I see some research just the other day, maybe Australian research, was still stated that, you know, the primary motivating factor for candidates moving jobs was still, you know, the compensation. Of course it is. And we shouldn't be ashamed of saying that. You know, none of us would work for free if there wasn't some sort of return involved. We have bills to pay, we have families to feed, etc. So, you know, we shouldn't be shy to say that.
And we have a really good value proposition here at EY, as do other firms in similar setup in professional services, which is you actually have the ability to be an equity owner, right, in this partnership, to become a partner. And that's something that, you know, it cannot be competed by a government, right? So, and it's actually true, you know, you can only rise so far in many organizations, government or private sector. Here, you can rise up to being, you know, a partner, an equity owner in a major, you know, business like EY.
Yeah, very, very interesting. I'm trying to find kind of comparators here. Because there's other regions in the world also have different policies and similar policies at times. I remember when we did kind of an Asia focus show, we talked to a couple of people from Malaysia, I believe it was, and they also have a system where, you know, there's different ethnicities in that country, and there's a requirement for, you know, there's representation for those ethnicities need to be at a certain place. And that creates all kinds of like recruiting constraints. It turns into like the dominant fact for a lot of recruiters out there because, you know, those targets are real. Same with South Africa, for instance. I've got lots of friends in South Africa. I think a lot of them watching here today. They are very familiar, of course, with, you know, the challenges required there and the stipulations needed. So these things are fascinating. They're very, very interesting. I tell you another thing, John, that's interesting is because the idea of creating quotas is starting to happen in places like in the US and UK and places like that, particularly when it comes to gender and ethnic diversity and stuff like this. And I think we need to kind of really be observant as to where quotas have been applied before in different parts of the world and kind of anticipate what some of those challenges might be. It's not just a case of sticking the number in. Like you said, John, it's about, you know, what is the ethos behind the number? You know, is it designed to penalize or is it designed to guide? You know, how is the government, if they're setting the rule, supporting this to happen as opposed to trying to penalize companies that don't make it? Those types of things I think are super important to be aware of for us that we can learn from your experience in MENA.
And ultimately, you know, as I said, it's an honorable goal. I mean, and it's an honorable goal because, you know, these countries, as they have developed, brought expats in, right? Especially the Gulf, the oil-rich countries, brought expats in because they needed people power and they needed expertise. But in the end, this is their country, right? And they should be have every opportunity to have the roles to influence their economy, to influence clients, etc. So, you know, we fully support you know, the goal that's after. This isn't just about checking a box that, oh, we've hit this quota. It's really about the big purpose here, right? And there is a higher purpose for what the governments are looking to achieve, and it's a benefit to the population and to the countries overall for their long-term growth and stability.
Can I ask how you've organized the team to achieve this, John? Have you kind of divided the team, one to focus on the population that are from outside in, and the other side to deal with the young entry talent from the native population?
Well, I will tell you in this specific question, I can't take a lot of credit for that organization. I inherited a really good team when I came here 3 years ago that was largely up and running. You know, from a campus perspective, we have I have an excellent campus team that is fully committed to this. And they have put together some bespoke programs, working with the government, working with students to give them opportunities. From an experienced hire perspective, there isn't a separate team. It's everyone's job. It's actually everyone's job to hire women and to hire nationals. It's everyone's job. Now, we have, I wish I had the luxury, to be really candid, to hire someone who could just focus on D&I, but I don't have that ability. I don't have that headcount. I'm really lucky that I have people who are passionate and who care, who do D&I. They step up and they do more because they care. So we have a D&I function without having a budget for a person to be leading it. And we have D&I initiatives. I'm really pleased to say that in the past 6 months, we announced a branding campaign that we call Inspire Her, that is to reinforce what I said earlier, to let women know that if you want a career in professional services, EY is the place to be, the place to look for that. We also will be looking to expand that for our nationals with Inspire Me, and ME being Middle East, and a couple of other things. And we see this as, you know, sort of the external equivalent of affinity groups that you see in some other countries for attracting talent.
Really interesting. John, let's move on to a different topic, which I'm fascinated to know whether it applies regionally here. Because again, if you speak to your friends in the US, everyone's talking about, hey, work from home, hybrid model, remote working, etc. Sergey and I were astonished when we were speaking to people in Singapore. So yeah, that's not happening. Everyone's back at the office. So is there a conversation in MENA about work from home? Or is that like literally not something people talk about? What is the status there?
Well, it is interesting. And first of all, I can't speak to all of MENA. I can speak to EY. And I think what I say at EY probably is applicable to our competitors in professional services. There has not been a rush to go back to the office. We actually christened a brand new office in a brand new building during this time of pandemic, and we haven't been asked to go back. It's really your choice. I think when we get back to a normal working world, the choices will be, or the preferences will be, first work at the client site, right? Because that's what we do. Secondly, then, you know, your choice as an employee to work from home or come into the office. But there is, it probably going back to where we were 14 months ago of working in the office every day with occasional times at home, won't be coming back. And I think what's really interesting about this to me is this region is a bit conservative in some ways. And I think it's a combination of maybe, you know, culturally, but also you have people from all these different regions as leaders. And so there hasn't been that history of empowering people to work remotely, to work flexibly. There's been pockets of it, but what's really beautiful, it sounds funny to say this, but what's really beautiful, a good thing that came out of this horrible, horrible global pandemic, is that I think leaders, not just at EY, but in general in this region, have learned they can trust people to work at home, to be productive, that they'll do the work. And actually, they probably work more than they would in the office because they're not going out for coffee or chit-chatting. And it's really been a huge paradigm shift to how people are led and managed here and empowered to be free. So we'll see where this goes. I know this isn't the only region in the world where this conversation is happening, but I do believe it's a vast leap from where this region was, just a short time ago.
I think, you know what, 14 months ago, remote work was very much a niche topic for everybody, John. outside of a few, you know, avant-garde open source software businesses out in San Francisco, you know, everyone was like pretty much office based. So this, I think, MENA and the rest of the world are pretty much in lockstep on this. Like I say, different parts of the world operate differently, seemingly mainly about how they dealt with the first wave of the pandemic, it seems. Like if you lock down early and you kind of controlled it, people seem to be back to office. But in other places where it's been bouncing around, we've got used and habituated to doing some form of work from away from the office. Maybe that will persist.
Two years ago, the conversation was around having sushi in the office and foosball tables. And now it's about remote working. So,
interestingly, though, if I may just chip in here, we have global offices. So UK is still in lockdown. Everyone is working from home. We in Hong Kong, I'm based in Hong Kong. We didn't really have a proper lockdown in the country here. There was a strong recommendation from the government that, you know, private companies should not disallow people to work from home. And we followed that. We made a distributed a memo. You can work from home, guys. And the element of trust was really, really important. And it proved that we can trust people. People can trust us. The productivity didn't go down, but what is funny is that when the restrictions relaxed, everyone came back to the office. Although we never kind of lifted that allowance to work from home. So what we have now, you are allowed to work, but here in Hong Kong, people still come to the office every day, almost every one of them.
Yeah, it's interesting. I can just tell you for myself, I love being in the office and being able to physically be with my team, the team that is actually here, because we're distributed all over the region. But I actually get really great, no pun intended, FaceTime with each and every individual, because we have a requirement. I put out a requirement that every conversation with my team members has to be via video. And it's really great. So there's a trade-off. But I don't think we've lost anything. I just think that we've gained in some other ways. That if I go if I were to go back into the office, I might miss this. Mm.
It's going to be very interesting. The second conversation that's happening, I wonder whether this is also occurring in MENA, is it seems there's a tension between the leadership in businesses and the individual contributors of a business about the work from home scenario. So the degree of flexibility, let's say. So in other words, leadership are basically leaning towards, you know what, back to the office generally is better. And this is happening UK and US, I would say mostly. And then there's pushback from the employees and saying, look, we like I ain't going to go down that commute again, you know, that kind of thing. So do you anticipate this situation also, John, or is it just a different vibe here at this point?
I think we're entering into a new era around talent, to be honest with you, because of everything that's happened over the past year. I think employees have a more empowered place at work, meaning, that what they want matters, okay? You know, I don't know if we all have, but some of us have seen the reports out there that there could be a mass talent exodus once this is over. And I think companies need to be aware of that. And I think, you know, I think the employees have some purchasing power, so to speak, some equity that they didn't have before. And if they really want whatever it is, working from home, or half work office, half work, whatever it is, I don't think companies can dictate like they used to, a one size fits all approach. And I think this is a really good thing. Look, all of us want to hire the best talent, and the best talent, you know, they don't all look the same, they don't act the same, and guess what? They don't all work the same. So I think it's real. I'm embracing it. I really am. It may be challenging, but I think it's really good overall for employees. And what's good for employees is good for employers.
Yeah, I think that that's it's very interesting times to move forward to. One thing I think is very important is that the work from office experience, 9 to 5, 5 days a week, was optimized for a certain type of person. And we've had however long periods of like decades of creating an environment that was optimized for this type of person. And this, you could look at that from a gender, demographic, ethnicity, mental approach, whatever it is, but there's loads of people that probably were not able to do their best because that format was simply too inflexible. And I would actually include myself in one of those. I know that over time, my like morale degrades by the grind. You know, we call it the grind for a reason, because it degrades your physicality, degrades your mentality. I think with cross fingers, we're going to get to a better place and be able to provide more options for staff to do their best work.
And think about this, if I may. You know, you think about what has always it's been termed the workplace of the future, right? That started about 20 years ago to be put out there that, you know, people don't want offices. They want to be out in open environments and open cubicles and stuff. Well, about 10 years, not even 10 years into that, studies show that people don't actually like that. They don't actually like that. But companies continue to do it, right? They continue to put people in this open environment where they're distracted or they can't speak as privately as they like or as openly as they want or as candidly. And so, you know, this is an opportunity to reset that particular progressive approach that I don't think was really successful.
Yeah, I think so. Cross fingers, everyone is going to get there. John, I've just noticed time. We're flying through. What I've got to do is go to these questions real quick. By the way, if anybody's got any questions for John, ask them and ask a question section. We're going to hit them right now. So Taz, let's go to Taz's question here. He said, or is it a she? I'm not sure. But let's go with Taz anyway. A question to the group. Challenges of hiring in the MENA region. Most suggestion volume applicants is the key issue. My question is twofold. Would it be a volume issue if you weren't posting all vacancies? And connected to that, why does everyone post vacancies? So what Taz is saying, look, don't complain about thousands of applicants, John. Stop posting the jobs and you don't have a problem.
So actually, Taz, that's a really good point and something we figured out. It's not rocket science. And so we used to post for specifically for audit, right? Because every year you have some turnover and audits the 50% of any big four business. So we would post in every location and we just got overwhelmed. And we got overwhelmed because we were getting duplicates. So one candidate would apply to every single one. So now we just really post, I think, three. We post one for nationals in Saudi, one for nationals here, and then one for everyone else. But you still get a lot of people. Everybody wants to come to Dubai, right? But that's a really good point.
Yeah. So, but that's definitely, I think, a legit thing. You can control it by not posting. I mean, sometimes there's the legal obligation to post, by the way, Taz. Some jobs, some requirements, you need to publish it. In the UK, for instance, definitely in government jobs, it needs to be published. So it could also have that impact. But in EY's case, you can control it at source. Okay. Question from Bas. Bas is saying, what kind of assessment or screening tech are you using for campus selection? So is there any tech involved there, or is it a case where it's more traditional style, you get the students in and you run a bunch of exercises with them?
Yeah, I think, look, I'm going to sort of punt on this simply because everything is changing in 6 weeks. We are going from Recruitment 2.0, which was the first ATS that came about 20 years ago, to where we're going now. And I'm not going to give specific details at this point, but I can tell you this. Our ATS is one thing, but we also know that we need a bespoke campus candidate relationship management system, and that's happening. I can also tell you that one of the things that I'm looking at is really taking advantage of the vast movement in assessment technology, specifically gamification around psychometrics. And I mean, you know, there's just better better ways of doing it. Better meaning better results and validation of candidates, but better for the candidate from a candidate experience perspective, and cheaper. And so we're in the midst of doing all these things. We're in the midst of change, but it's a good question because we have to change that. I mean, as recruiting professionals, we always have to change, and we're at that flex point of AI, right, of gamification, of all these technologies. And by the time we start to adopt those, they'll be the next thing, and that's just our lives.
That's fantastic. Sounds like there's a very exciting couple of months ahead for you, John. It'd be great to get a report, actually, to see what you've implemented. That sounds like a perfect thing.
I'm doing something exciting that I won't talk about, but I'm happy to in about 9 months' time.
teaser. That's about it. John, it's been absolutely fascinating speaking with you. Melissa, I'm really sorry that we lost you. I've been trying to get you back like periodically, but I don't think you've either seen or been able to activate that. So real apologies to you, Melissa. We'll try and get you back at some other point. John, Dudley, this has been really fascinating. Let me leave you with a final word on this. If you could speak to people out there who are thinking about MENA as a region to recruit, to potentially do a job, maybe as a recruiter, what would you say to that person? What are the steps they need to make that happen?
I can answer that question. And then I'd like to just say a thank you at the end. Here's the thing. When I accepted the job to come here, my predecessor, who I'm good friends with, he still works for UI now in another region. He told me that, it's really complex. It's really complex. I'm like, oh, come on, how complex is it going to be? I've worked in Latin America. That's fairly complex. No, it's complex here. And here's what I want to tell you as a recruiter. If you can recruit here, you can recruit anywhere. What you will learn here, the problems you will solve, the situations you will be in, the wisdom you will gain is one of the best universities for our profession that there is. And that's just a fact. And I know that every recruiter who's on this call right now in this region or who has been in this region resonates. It's great. It was hard. My first year I have gray hair. It's not my first time around the barn, so to speak. But I will tell you, it was the hardest year of my professionally. It was hard, but the growth and the exhilaration. I mean, now we're here. I have this an amazing team. I mean, it's really been great. And so embrace it. If you embrace change, being uncomfort, good things happen. Two other things, and I promise I'll do it in 60 seconds. Well, I'll try. The first thing is this. I would love for some of my fellow recruitment leaders here in the region to reach out to me. I think, and maybe this exists, but I think we need some sort of a roundtable where we can really talk about how we partner, how we work with the government, how we change mindsets, how we come together, because we all face the same problem, right? And even if we're competitors, it doesn't matter. We're trying to help change the paradigm here for the good of the people and the good of the governments. I would welcome that opportunity for us.
Hold that thought. Everybody, you hear that call out. If you're interested, please comment in the chat stream on Crowdcast and on LinkedIn and Facebook. I'll get your sort of details together and I'll crunch them all together in some sort of mailing list and get you guys together. Because why not? I mean, one of the main things that I've learned is through community, peer-to-peer communities across companies, that's where you get the best learning. Because we're often facing the same challenges and spending the same energy solving the same problem, and the person on the other side of the street might have already got the solution. So definitely try and do that. As I say, get in touch with me directly if you want to do that, and I'll make sure those things get connected. But make yourself visible in the chat stream, folks. I want to hear from you. Sorry, Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, so just the last thing. Thank you very much for this opportunity. I really thank you mostly for setting this up and care. You care. I mean, that's just appreciated by all of us, right? It's appreciated by all of us. I also thank you. I had no idea you were going to call me out, have me on until you said, no idea. I'm glad I wore a nice shirt today. I thank you all very much. I thank the people who've attended. Unfortunately, I can see there's comments scrolling, but I haven't been able to look at them. I just really appreciate this opportunity to represent not just EY, but to represent the entire recruitment community and the issues that we face here in the MENA region. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, John, I think you've done an amazing job of that. I think we can all agree. Do give us an update on your kind of tech implementation rollout. It looks like some toys being used here, and we want to hear all about that. But John, you have a good day. It's been wonderful having you on with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
What a great guy. I could definitely start.
I love the insights. I love the concept of returnship. It was a fascinating talk to him.
It was so good. And I'm really sorry we couldn't get Melissa on either, because I'm sure she was still watching all the way through. Damn it, the internet is not working for us. Anyway, that's about it for this week. Thanks everybody for watching the show. We hope you've enjoyed it. We're going to be back next week on Friday. I'm still going to be Hong Kong time, but we're going to do it a little bit earlier in UK at 12 o'clock, I think. We're going to be talking about storytelling. How do you become a better storyteller? Because there's not a content marketer out there. There's not a recruitment person that's creating any kind of media or copy that isn't thinking, oh, I'm a storyteller. Guess what I've got lined up for you? I've actually brought in professional storytellers into the panel. We're talking film directors, actors, novelists. They're joining the panel. Nobody in recruiting. We're going to get them together and say, okay, how do you construct the story? What are the elements of a good story? How do you pace that story? How do you make sure people are watching from the first moment to the end moment to your call to action? It's going to be absolutely fascinating. Make sure you follow the channel and you'll get an update as to when that show is happening. Okay, that's about it. Sergey, by the way, really great to have you. I know you're keeping quiet most of the time because the audio was not brilliant. So I just want to thank you for that.
I figured out what's happened. I started the show on both browsers, so it was a cross-feeding. Sorry.
I should have clocked on that, but thank you for, I wouldn't say thank you for keeping quiet, because I like hearing your voice, Sergey, but I got the impression you're also feeling a little bit, you didn't want to do an audio crash on it. Anyway, check out Datra, folks. If you are doing anything with regards to improving the data quality of your candidate database, Datra are the business that you need to think about. Sergey, you want to say one final word on Datra before we let you go?
I guess, Kung, you put it very well once for me. Datra is on a mission to make our clients' data work better for them.
That's it. And one of the things that is super important, by the way, is that we're collecting so much data now because we've moved to a digital space. Remote working is a shift to digital. There's no question we need to get our data hygiene sorted out. Mm. Datra.com, a venerable business, been around forever. They're still one of the leading players in this space. All right, that's about it. Sergey, I'll see you later, hopefully. I am in town. So once I get out of this...
Once I get out of this hotel, you finish your quarantine. Yeah,
I'll see you shortly, man. Lunch.
All right. Everyone, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn or via Zoom. Thank you very much for joining the show.
See you later, Sergey.
Thanks.
All right, that's it, everyone. I will see you later. Thank you so much for joining. I hope you've enjoyed it.